Brilliant. I'm going to start with the first question, actually, Loz. I'm going to ask you this because I was really struck both when we first corresponded and during your talk, but how personal this experience was. And I think that resonated with Phil's talk as well, that this is very much a way for people to connect back into their history. And I think for Ian as well, that's something which we hope to do with the Dornier exhibition, is to connect people with that history. So Loz, can you just talk about how you found that experience in particular and the work you did around it, and what you feel these crash sites mean to people who actually go there and experience them?
Again, I'm still processing it. This was July last year, and I still don't feel the full impact of what we did up there, really, because there's so much we did in such a short amount of time that it was still quite hard to process it, really. But the main aim of the project, as well as, you know, sort of journeying through my heritage, was to inspire other people to do that as well. Because as tragic as my great-grandfather's story is, as, you know, shown by the other crash sites, it can be repeated so many times. And people might have these stories in their own family history that they might just not know about, or not necessarily even with the military, but their own heritage. And I think having a sort of relationship with that is important into how we go through our own lives, you know.
When we showed Fred's before, and I've said I do really love that installation. I think there's something really pilgrimage-like about it, sort of mapping a route up to the mountain. Okay, do we have any questions on the floor?
Phil, you showed a map in your presentation of that operation into bombing, was it Nuremberg?
Yeah, Nuremberg. Era.
All the numbers of all the crash sites on that map, were they all that one night?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, 95 aircraft, I think. I think it's very slightly, but yeah. Yeah, most were shot down in that hour after midnight. So I think there's something like 200 to 300 night fighters infiltrated the bomber stream, and you know, they were the bombers were right where they expected them to be, and it was carnage, it's fair to say. And a lot went missing in that short period of time, so it's terrible, really. More air crew were killed on that one operation than the entire Battle of Britain.
This one's for Phil as well. You were talking about connections with Europe. We've been helping Loz out because we've got a Facebook group to do with 148. We found over the years the amount of remembrance in Europe actually outstrips Britain. And it's sad that we've got so many, like Loz's great-grandfather, sites which are in Europe. But as you're saying, this connection really needs to be fostered to, you know, work with Poland especially. We've got, I think it was about three relatives who fathers were out there, and the way they've been taken on by the local residents of Poland is absolutely amazing. And then when you're talking about the remains and not being able to do sites in Britain, and the British, in fact, some of the ways it's the Europeans are leading this compared to our own government. I've found in our research that we've actually got the actual local ambassadors. In fact, we had one of the American ambassadors. He found a site in Albania and he was leading it and had to actually get the British to come along with him. So is there any more sort of routes to follow that from the British side?
Well, I think we need more of these sort of examples showing how important it is to groups of people to investigate these sites. And I think you're absolutely right. I see the same thing. There's communities where they take on the management, essentially, of that site and the people, stories who are associated with it. They take that on and are very respectful and very helpful whenever you work with them. And I think it's a sort of lesson. Something we could do more of that in the UK. But I think there's just been a reluctance to sort of grasp the nettle, particularly with issues surrounding human remains. I think that in the UK we tend to play it safe, and that's. I think there's been some unfortunate events that have happened on crash sites in the past, which have sort of, you know, caused public outrage, and I think that's sort of really coloured how we do things now. But I think attitudes are changing, and of course we get slightly more distance from the events as well, a little less personal, perhaps. So it's allowing us to think about it in a different way, and I hope we'll see a change, a positive change, fairly soon.
Thank you. Hello. I would like to suggest to Ian, when you were contemplating what to do with your beautiful aircraft now, to make sure more people can see the achievement of getting it off the sands at Goodwin Sands, if you could do a collaboration with a museum in Germany that had rescued an English plane and make a really wonderful dialogue about the way that your good practice here corresponds with stuff there. And then I had a quick question for Loz, just wondering, when you talked about the reliquary idea in the forest, did you burnish your gold edge onto that sort of...
I did, so it's all with a really sticky varnish, and so it'll stay on there forever.
Forever?
And it's 24 carats, so it'll never tarnish either, which, again, for me, like we were saying before about you want to leave a legacy behind you, it's like it's adding to that legacy. And like you were saying as well, about connecting people and families and bringing them to the sites. I mean, one of the points that stood out for me, what you were talking about, was how communities have come together, so, and from different countries. And I think that's when we're talking about legacy of war, I think that is such a huge, important part of it, that although conflicts in the past, such sort of devastating events can bring communities together to highlight these things and make something really beautiful happen, which is similar to like Francesco and me linking up, you know, random Italian man like and random British woman, and coming together to create this really sort of poignant project, who never would have met otherwise, who never would have, you know, sort of shared these stories.
And so, are you not worried that someone's going to steal the little piece of gold?
No. If you don't know it's there, you don't know where it is. Okay. it's very remote.
You didn't use any heat or anything to get
it's
stick.
Just literally with a brush varnish, and then took up the leaves of gold and stuck it on, and it'll be there forever.
No, it's very good.
It's a question for Phil. My name is Peter Masters. I'm from Cranfield University. And for the over last 8 years or so, I've been writing the new integrated approach to recovery of military aircraft crash sites. And I've undertaken quite a number of these sites now with the MOD archaeologist Richard Osgood. Coming on to your point about human remains, all military aircraft crash sites are actually graves. They are registered as graves in this country. In the UK. In 2015, we recovered the Spitfire Kerala in the Great Fen. In the records, from the RAF records, they actually had recovered the pilot officer, Penketh, in 1940, when he had crashed. Actually, they didn't. They did not recover the full remains. When we excavated the remains of the aircraft, over 6 metres down, in Fenland peat and clay, we found the remains of over 75% of Penketh. Not only that, not only the bone, but more, I'm afraid. We found some fleshy remains. So hence why I still feel that the preservation of these sites should be kept as they are. I know that a lot of them, the crew were recovered from it, but I disagree with that we should slacken the law in this country on the recovery of these remains.
Yeah, I mean, I take your point, obviously, and that's exactly the kind of example of site which has really set the tone for this whole discussion. I suppose what I would say to that is that there are other views, particularly relating to relatives of crew members. And I think, you know, the example, I didn't sort of really tackle it in very much detail, but the JU-88 site on Thorny Island, that aircraft hit the ground at high speed, and as you can imagine, the clear-up operation was, you know, was pretty difficult. The crew are buried in a communal plot at the church at Thorny Island, but there is clearly human remains left on the site. So, if you take a family's perspective, do you feel, you know, does a family member feel comfortable with the idea that some parts of their relative are in a grave and some parts are in the hole in the ground? And indeed, a hole in the ground where we don't actually know where it is. So somewhere randomly on the airfield. And of course, if you then develop the aerodrome, as many have been, you might come across them by accident. Maybe people wouldn't recognise what it was. And so I think there's a kind of, you have to take it on a case-by-case approach. And I think absolutely, you know, playing it safe is definitely the way forward, isn't it? I mean, and there's other examples where the MOD has denied access, a license to excavate a site because the pilot was killed in association with a particular aircraft, but in fact they'd ejected out and were killed outside the aircraft. But still, the fact there's a fatality linked to the aircraft means you can't touch it. So I think there's a kind of host of little issues surrounding that, and I think that the devil is in the detail. But I absolutely take your point, and these things do happen. But it's very interesting to see the US approach to that. The fact that recovery of human remains is extremely important. In fact, it's the key thing, rather than recovering bits of the aircraft. It's the human remain presence. But interesting.
Yes, Seb's eagerly got his hand up.
Seb Cox, I'm the head of the Air Historical Branch in the Ministry of Defence. We are consulted on the licensing issue as to, in the jargon, if you like, whether there are bombs or bodies. If we know the pilot has bailed out and is therefore not in the wreck, we will advise the licensing authority that there is, assuming there's no ordnance on the machine, we will advise the licensing authority that there is no reason to refuse a license. So let's be clear about that one.
You never know who's in the audience, do you? That's good. That's good. It's interesting to hear.
So that's point one. The other issue, of course, with human remains and what we've just heard is that the wartime recovery of these wrecks took place under a great deal of pressure, not least because they were coming down all over the place. So the recovery teams were working under quite intense pressure. They didn't have the advantage of some of the modern machinery that you see on some of the slides that you've shown earlier. There were no JCBs in those days. Modern excavating machinery is a lot easier to use and a lot more efficient than what was available to the RAF recovery teams at the time. And lastly, of course, if an aircraft comes down from about 25,000 feet and it's on fire, and it still has the bomb load on board, if the bomb load detonates when it hits the ground, which was certainly not unknown, then sadly, the human remains can be spread over just as wide, if not wider, an area as the wreckage itself. So it's not quite as easy as you might think to say, oh, well, why don't we go and find them? And lastly, on the American side, we've actually just had some of the guys from the American team over with us looking for Americans who were killed with the RAF and looking at our casualty records. The budget for the American missing agency is in the region of $70 million a year. I would love to have $70 million in my branch per year, but that is the reality of what you're talking about, of what it costs. And of course, a lot of the American, let's be quite clear about this too, a lot of what drives that American, why does the Senate vote $70 million a year to that agency? Well, if I was to say Vietnam, then you might know better why that agency gets the level of funding from the US, who, of course, much richer anyway, but that is principally the reason that drove the establishment of that organization in the first place.
Yeah, I mean, I should say that I'm not advocating digging everything up. That's not what I'm suggesting by any means. Horses for courses, site by site.
My name's Colin Welch. The recovery of the Dornier involved, part of the process involved actually deciding what the aircraft identity was.
That's right.
And I hope that you can put some light and shade on what Mr. Seb Cox has just said regarding the archaeological investigation, stage by stage investigation to determine what an aircraft is on site. Can you give any sort of perspective on the inhibition that the current legislation places on that identification?
Not in depth, no. We just had to be... We had to provide good evidence that the aircraft that we thought it was.
Clearly, there is a lot of public interest in such projects, and this field of archaeology, as far as I'm concerned, is experiencing a massive updraft of interest. Given that a pilot may have lost his life in an aircraft crash, the first stage of identification currently is inhibited by the legislation. And from an archaeological point of view, some people may argue that it's quite important to be able to get an identity at least. So some form of initial survey may be considered by the current establishment. Do you have any point of view on that regarding the Dornier?
As I say, we had to do a survey of the wreck before we made a decision to raise it to ensure that there were no human remains on board. There was no ordnance on board. But we had to get the... We couldn't say for certain it was the aeroplane we think it is. There are no data plates on board, for example. We think they've been removed by wreck hunters in the past. But through working through the Air Historical Branch, we did our due diligence and came up with what we thought had to be that particular aeroplane. It was the only aircraft that fitted the particular circumstance.
So stage one would be to get identification narrowed down.
Absolutely.
Ian, in the recent past, I've been in contact with a fellow in Nanton, Alberta. I'm not sure if you're familiar with the museum there.
I am, yeah.
And they are in the process, if not already brought up, but you were mentioning the Norwegians. And I believe they've recovered a Halifax bomber from a fjord in Norway. I believe that's true. And I'm just curious whether you had any consultation or have spoken with those people at all about that, considering your experience with the Dornier here.
There's not a Halifax at Nanton. There's a Halifax at Trenton.
No, they have a Lancaster at Nanton. I understand that. Sorry.
We haven't actually dealt with them directly, but we do occasionally get some questions from other museums that are interested in recovering aeroplanes, and they ask for our experience. We had a question from the Flying Heritage Combat Armor Museum up at Seattle. They're interested in recovering, I think, some Italian aeroplanes, but that didn't come to anything. But yeah, where we can assist, and we have done. I think they recovered a couple of, was it Northrop Nomads as well, from in Canada in recent times.
Do we have any final questions? Okay, well, I'm gonna ask one final one then, and that is about, again, it comes back to this experience. And Phil, you've recovered objects from the Lancaster wreck. And I remember in your talk in 2018 up in Wolverhampton, you said, you know, what do you do with these things? You brought it up again. Loz has got some artifacts here today, and it comes down to Ian about how we choose to exhibit the Dornier. I think it's a question for all of you. It's a case of what is the most important thing to do with these objects? What is it we really want to accomplish with them?
Well, we want them to tell the story, don't we, that they were involved in. But I mean, in the Dornier's case, you've got a substantial object which has got a very interesting story in its own right. That is the point. But it's an interesting challenge, actually.
Yeah, I mean, I think the power of these objects is that they connect you to a particular incident, a particular moment in time. You know the aircraft, you know the people on board, you know what they were part of, and these objects are a direct connection to that. And as you've seen, you know, with the talk that Loz did, you know, the individual objects can be very powerful to individual people. But these were there, and I think that's the thing, on the spot at that moment in time, and that's the experience of the people that visit these sites. That's their connection. They're the place where it happened. And I think that's the thing. Whether you can't keep endless amounts of twisted metal, can you, in a store? And there'd be museum curators quaking just at the thought of doing so. The guy at the university who deals with storage costs says to me, you know, this is the cost per square meter of storing stuff. So please stop collecting that rubbish. And I get that. But there's some objects that you could keep longer to help tell the story. Things that people recognise. Twisted bits of metal are kind of difficult for people. But there are some objects that you straight away you know what they are, and they hold a specific power.
I think I agree there. There's one thing to be told a story or to read about it, but to have a physical object that you can immediately connect with, especially a personal item that, you know, everybody wears something with buttons on. Everyone wears shoes. You know, it immediately puts you in that person's position, and like, which makes the story more visceral. And to have that connection with objects, I think, is the important thing, again, for the learning, to the telling the story, to have these things to have a purpose now. They were machines of war. They had a purpose then. What are their purposes now? And I think it is to tell those stories so we don't forget, we don't, you know, which we continue to do, but we try not to repeat these things. And I think having these visceral objects really helps in that sort of objective. So,
well, thank you all very much. I think before we thank Phil, Laws and Ian one final time for a fantastic talk today, I'd also like to thank Mike, who's helped out at the big start, handing you all leaflets. There's still some at the front if you want them, and for running along the side. Thank you very much, Mike. And also to Barney and David, who have helped out with the audio and the sound, done a fantastic job. It's the first time we've done one of these debates, so it's been a bit of a challenge to think how we're going to fit everyone onto the stage and everything. So, you know, thank you very much for your hard work. And finally, thank you, Phil, Laws and Ian, for a fantastic talk.